First Rand is a giant in financial services, employing nearly 50,000 people with recent earnings of almost 30 billion rand and a sector-leading return on equity. The group is made up of world-class companies such as Rand Merchant Bank and First National Bank and West Bank, and helped spawn the likes of OUTsurance and Discovery along the way. The First Rand story isn't so much rags to riches as it is self-made in Stellenbosch in South Africa. It's a story about the rise of a business empire and the extraordinary tale of a trio of entrepreneurs, the partnership of GT Ferreira, Laurie Dippenaar and Paul Harris, who founded a first successful startup, Rand Consolidated Investments. They then merged this successfully with the fledgling Merchant Bank and grew Rand Merchant Bank into a market leader. Next came a leap of faith into unknown territory with the acquisition of a listed company, the life insurer Momentum Life. Through a reverse takeover, that business underwent a dramatic turnaround and cultural transformation. And the next very big deal was a game changer. It entailed a risky merger with the country's oldest retail bank, First National Bank, dwarfing the size of their other businesses and operating in vastly different ways to the founders' hallmarks. The FNB merger was a massive challenge and yet one that paid off in an unprecedented fashion. The FNB merger coincided with the formation of First Rand, and this really in a nutshell is how the group's history has unfolded. RMB Holdings decided this year to go ahead with the unbundling of its 34% stake in banking group First Rand in a move that has unlocked around 5.5 billion rand in value for shareholders. The transaction ends a 27-year association between the two companies, leaving RMH with a portfolio of property development assets in South Africa and Eastern Europe, and RMH listed on the JSE back in 1992, giving investors a vehicle to co-invest with founders. In 2011, its insurance interests were separately listed as RMI, and it said it had helped First Rand grow its market cap from 35 billion in 1998 to about 228 billion. And the decision to unbundle was partly due to the widening discount that its shares traded at relative to their intrinsic value. Now, RMB Holdings announced sweeping changes to its board this month, including the resignation of two of the founding three musketeers, directors Paul Harris and Laurie Dippenaar, following the completion of the unbundling of that shareholding in First Rand. The two directors have been on the board for 32 years. Paul and Laurie, welcome to the show. Without trying to make you feel any older than you are there, Laurie, as MBA textbooks will still be written about this story, about what the three founders contributed individually and collectively to First Rand's success, what sort of emotion are you filled with when looking back on such an incredible journey?
Michael, I think it's one of pride, obviously, and a certain sense of amazement, because when we started, the intention was never size. It just happened. We just happened to grow very large with all the acquisitions, which had our other strategic intent. And then I suppose the other emotion is a sense of gratefulness to all the our management teams that help us build this empire. I often say to people, I think the one thing we got right was to create an environment that attracted talented people. That was the foundation. And then the management teams, they created the skyscrapers on our foundation we created. And I think the handover from owner managers to professional managers was a long evolutionary process. So it wasn't heart-wrenching. It wasn't flag up, flag down in one day. But I think one little thing I think that was interesting was our last board meeting for RMH, the one where we stayed. That was now the last board meeting after 32 years. And because of the nature, it was a Zoom meeting. It ended just with us logging off. No handshakes, no hand clapping, anything. The irony of these times, you just log off.
Absolutely. And as someone, Laurie, who's been a long-suffering Liverpool supporter watching the team win the Premier League in empty stadiums, one can certainly empathise with that sort of feeling. It's an interesting time as well to be logging off, and we'll come back to that as well. But just going back to the beginning of the story, Paul, and how it all started all those years ago in 1977, and I'm sure it's been told 1,000 times. In fact, you were brought in after Pat Goss had to go off and deal with a family bereavement. Just tell me about the foundations of RCI and how that all began.
Well, just very quickly, GT got hold of Pat Goss, suggested that they start a company. GT was already involved in so-called leverage leasing in those days. When Pat sort of agreed, he said, can he bring Lowry along? They needed a steady hand, I suppose. So that's how the three of them started. And then shortly thereafter, you know, within a couple of months, Pat's dad passed away, and I then joined the company. And there was another guy, Yanni Kitsoff, was also at that stage in the company. He left shortly thereafter. But, those were the early days, and then one thing led to another, and we eventually merged with Rand Merchant Bank, which at that stage had been started by Johan Rupert and a group of friends. So in a sense, we all sort of knew each other, and that was a convenient thing certainly for Johan, who needed to go down to Stellenbosch to look after the family interests. And that's how RMB started.
And when you say...
RMB was started by Johan Rupert, and then we merged in 84.
And it's interesting you say that you all knew each other, and when you talk about values as well, Laurie, values are not something that you sit down and when you first meet someone you say, what are your values? You gravitate towards people who you share common interests with, and that's certainly reading through the story that has been told of the First Rand Group many times. What stands out here is that there was this shared value system amongst the three founders, and also even with Johan Rupert as well. How important do you think that shared value system was in bedding down the vision of philosophy of the group?
I think it was critically important. It's a bit like a marriage. If you marry a person and you don't share the same value system, in my view, the marriage is unlikely to last. And I call that, it was just fortunate with the way we'd all grown up. We grew up with a similar value system. And from the first day, if you think of our payoff line, that was for Rand Merchant Bank, it was traditional values, innovative ideas. And when we asked him, how did you arrive at this payoff line? And he said, that's what I observed in my spending. And those four words epitomizes what you guys were all about. And there you have it, traditional values.
And hard work as well. I believe your secretary started with a high-tech calculator, and you certainly didn't pay yourself salaries right at the very beginning as well. And it just shows you the sort of humble beginnings that this came from. Paul, it always rankles Stephen Kossoff when I chat to him about the story of Investec. And I reference that it started as a bucket shop in downtown Johannesburg. And it's certainly something of the First Rand story as well, starting very small. How do you think you differed from Investec in your growth and journey? And perhaps how do you think the two groups are similar?
We certainly started roughly the same time. We were in financial services. But the early days of RCI, the main business was big ticket funding. We funded big things, like we disintermediated the capital the banks. So we went directly to the capital market. That's what's being done today when people package deals. But we did that with big tickets, in other words, big public works, big buildings, that type of thing. So we were, let's say, in the big ticket stuff. And then for a long time, the biggest revenue after project finance was, in fact, in trading in the bond markets, and trading in the futures markets for about 5 or 6 or maybe longer years. That was sort of 80% of our revenue. So that's how we started. And then from there, from trading in the markets, trading in the bond markets and futures markets and that type of thing, that's how we developed the other parts of the business. So in a sense, Investec started as financing motor cars and that type of thing, let's say more in the consumer space. And we were more in the capital market space. And then we went into things like corporate finance, into project finance, and that type of thing. And then so did Investec. So we're pretty similar in the way that we started. And then the amazing thing is that over the years we've been competitors. So we play hard on the field and so on, but we've always had a huge respect for one another. We've got a huge admiration for what they've done. And I think that's been one of the things that given me and us a lot of pleasure is that, you know, that you don't, if you compete, you don't have to be enemies. You can be friends, but that doesn't mean to say you aren't very competitive.
Now that's
been our relationship with Investec.
Certainly what comes through through your personal stories as well and your affiliation with Cricket South Africa, Paul, and I know your love of the Springboks as well, Laurie. The successful turnaround at Momentum, so following the RMB deal with you at the helm as chairman, Laurie, was another milestone in the evolution of the group. How did you change the mindset inside the business from one of copying to one of innovation and embracing that innovation and traditional values?
It was quite an interesting story because they were quite hierarchical when we acquired them. So we had to invent ways of breaking down hierarchy. So we did a couple of novel things. The first was we had a graffiti wall with spray cans that we erected at the head office. So anybody could go and write something like the chairman is an idiot. Or whatever he wanted to write. But it was, again, just to break down hierarchy. We did away with titles, formal titles, like general manager, etc., to more descriptive titles, head of IT, because the one killed another. Then we did away with fixed parking bays. You know, the normal hierarchical organization that CEO and chairman park close to the lift. So what we did was we said that there are no designated parking bays. The chief executive has to go and hunt for a bay the same as everybody else. We changed the dress code. So you only probably need to wear a suit if you're actually seeing clients. So it didn't happen by accident. It was a concerted program of breaking down hierarchy because in a very hierarchical organization, it's difficult to get them to be innovative. And I think it was it really worked well. We had the help of a clinical psychologist in the group who thought up a lot of these methods of breaking down hierarchy.
Die Kop Doctor, as he's known inside the group. Now, 1998 was a transformative year for the group, and the next very large deal for the business, which resulted in the daring takeover of FNB and Southern Life, and that resulted in the merger that culminated eventually in FirstRand. Paul, if you look at that time, what really stands out for you in a transaction that many thought was extremely daring for a group the size that you were at that stage, to take on one of the country's oldest banks, and with it Southern Life as well? And at that stage, I mean, we know FNB's reputation now. It certainly wasn't that back then.
Yeah, it was sort of the goldfish swallowing the whale. That's how we described it at that stage. But it was quite daunting. You know, it really was this huge company. And we thought that the way to tackle it would be to address the cultural aspects, try and change the culture of the organization, and in that way get people to fix whatever needed to be fixed from within, as it were. So we spent a lot of time just talking to people and trying to get consensus as to what type of company we want to build. And what we brought into it, I think, was an entrepreneurial flair. And we pushed this whole concept of intrapreneurialism. In other words, entrepreneurialism within a big organization. And over a period of time, the way that our culture evolved into this concept of owner-manager culture, which was pretty sort of new in those days. And when we were asked, what does that mean? It basically says that in a business environment, when you're working for a company, the decisions you make and the way you conduct yourself must be as if it were your own company. So generally that is a good at the end of the day, that's a good criteria against which to manage business decisions. So that's the culture we try to inculcate into the company. I must say that we broke down a lot of things. We broke down hierarchy and so on, and we learned a lot. You know, we made a lot of mistakes. We realized, and I used to catch Viv Bartlett's eye across the table often in a board meeting where we would dismantle something, you know, these young bucks coming in and dismantling a process that had developed over years. And then we found after a while that, you know, in order to manage this thing properly, you have to put those, some of those processes back in. So we reintroduced them. But I think what we did is we really went for the hearts of people. You know, we just felt that if we could win the hearts over and get people to think of businesses in a different way, that we could achieve something. And I think over a longer period, I think we did achieve that. We changed the mindset and created a different culture in the company.
As we know, Viv Bartlett was succeeded by Michael Jordan, who came from that culture inside the R&B stable. And, well, as I say, the rest is history. We certainly know what he achieved with F&B. Laurie, what role did Anglo director Mike King play in that particular deal? Because as I recall at the time, Southern Life seemed to be the jewel and not necessarily F&B.
In fact, it was a key role because the deal started by Momentum looking to take over Southern Life because it was ailing. And when we approached Anglo with the idea of acquiring Southern Life, Mike King was the one that said, look, if you will sell, but you must buy F&B too. Now, I mean, it wasn't, we hadn't thought of that. We had a retail strategy in the back of our mind. Eventually we need a retail bank, but not quite then. But it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to acquire a Main Street a bank like that. So, and obviously it was terribly daunting. I mean, it was huge. Mike King did almost all the negotiations on behalf of Anglo. It was mostly he and GT. Those were the sort of the pointsmen, to put it that way. And GT just said, he's a really, really a tough negotiator, Mike King. And then he subsequently joined the board, chaired the audit committee, which he did a brilliant job at, and be an excellent non-executive director. But in a way, as I say, he played in adding F&B into the equation for us to buy.
And Laurie, I'm sure you had to put any aspirations of more cycling time to one side when you realized just the size of this whale that the goldfish was trying to swallow.
No, it was daunting. And I think I just want to emphasize what Paul said. We were merchant bankers, not retail bankers, and we changed something, and then 2 years later, we go the full back to what it was, you know. I suppose that's part of the learning process.
And within that, you mentioned the Kop Doctor earlier, Francois Hichu. What role did he play in enabling an environment where you could dismantle something, and obviously at a level where you're dealing with people who are all very capable, not break down relationships that might become irreparable as a result of this as well? Just to explain the importance of having someone of Francois' skills on board.
Okay, so one of his big roles was also, we used to have Paul and I ran with him for almost the whole group, but especially new recruits, a whole day with them in an auditorium dealing with the culture and the ethos of the group. Okay, so he was very instrumental in participating in that. And then I can just speak for me personally, he was a tremendous advisor to me on people matters, you know, when you have to deal, just talk to me about them. This is what I want to do. How do you think you should go about it? And he was also very, very good at team building. So if we had a division which wasn't operating well as a team, he would run these team building sessions in an extremely good manner. As you know, he then subsequently asked by SA Cricket to do the same there. But his biggest role for me personally was as a really trusted advisor on all people matters.
Now, I don't know who was the most risk-averse amongst the three of you, and it's a pity we don't have GT on the call. You were the most risk-averse, Laurie. It was all about Laurie's logic then, was it? Who was the one who wanted to dive in? Was that Paul?
Yep. GT somewhere in between. But it all balanced out.
And I would imagine that's part and parcel of the recipe or the secret of the successful partnership, is that you all brought different strengths to the table. Laurie, you've also been known as Mr. Big Deal and also Best Business Brain, if you chat to some of your colleagues. If one were to be used as a fitting tribute to you, what would you like your legacy to be?
I suppose the best legacy is that they just continue with the success that we've achieved to date. You know, I think we've seen as a country, you have one bad leader, and it sits decades, all right? And I think the legacy I would love is that they continue, as they've done to date, to choose the right leaders in the group that perpetuate the success that this group has had. And then, okay, the other one that I think, I think trust is incredibly important in any organization, you know, and it's deep trust which is important. So let's put it this way. A bank, everybody trusts the bank to pay back their deposits. Otherwise they wouldn't put their money there. But do they trust the bank to give them the best deal? In other words, a deal that's also good for the customer. Mm. Now, I'm not saying we're there, but that's the type of thing I'd like to see happen in the future.
And, I mean, you make that comment at a time when we do see so much innovation, Vodacom announcing a deal with Alipay, and your competitors are coming from different sectors and all around you. And the banks still have a huge advantage, but they have to be able to crack that nut in order to compete in, yes, in the future. I'd just like to end off this conversation with a reflection on where we find ourselves as a country. And Laurie, back to you, there was an article in 2014 reflecting on the global financial crisis where you said you felt like you were a ship in a hurricane, and at under threat was everything that you had built through no fault of your own. And I think right now in the world, and indeed in South Africa, many businesses, small businesses, larger businesses, must feel the same way. The pandemic has hit, the shutdown, the economic lockdown has caused untold economic harm, and many business owners must be feeling that their livelihoods, their efforts have been eroded through no fault of their own. How do you respond to the decision, firstly, to lock down for as long and as hard as we did? And then secondly, how do we rebuild? Because I think those are probably the two most important issues in the country at the moment.
Look, I think probably history will tell if lockdown was the right strategy. But I think we also have to take comfort that, that almost every single country in the entire world. Now, the thing where it worked the very best happened to be an authoritarian society like China. You think about that. The severity of their lockdown surpassed anything else the rest of the world, and they've largely, whereas the rest of the world, we lock down hard, and the moment we open the taps, the virus has taken off. I think what this has shown to everybody is if you held fault lines in your company, you were overgeared, that type of thing. It's now shown up and could prove fatal. And it's the companies with that are resilient and have big reserves, low gearing, will survive. But I mean, it is my heart bleeds for, as I say, many, many good, where they did nothing wrong, and they're now in this terrible predicament. And I don't know, I'm not certain what all the answers are to get this out of this, to be honest.
Paul, I'm going to throw the ball, swing the ball down the line to you, and ask you whether or not we can indeed retrieve the situation as a country right now. There are lots of economic plans on the table. There's the Business for South Africa plan. There's the ANC's document. There's the Treasury document. They all seem to converge around infrastructure, where they might diverge perhaps is on how we fund this. And as a business that's really built around project finance and funding big ticket infrastructure projects over time, what needs to be done? What needs to happen from your vantage point to ensure that we can unlock infrastructure as this catalyst for growth? Can it be done?
Yeah, I think we should just start off by saying that we have been in similar positions in South Africa and we've come through them. You know, if you just go back to the transition, the debt standstills and that type of thing. So yes, it's dire, it's grave where we are, and I think it's unprecedented. I must say, I don't think the, when people say they people get written up as being experts. Nobody's an expert in what this thing is. This is something totally different. You have to think on your feet. But yes, infrastructure definitely is one of the ways. I think entrepreneurialism. I think that this whole concept of the fourth industrial revolution, it's concertinaed into 4 months. You know, here we are speaking on Zoom. This wouldn't have happened, I don't know how long ago. So a lot of the things that were going to take a long time to come about have come about. I think in the medical field you'll find it. You'll find it in all fields. So the base on which we'll start will be a totally different base. And it may be that we've got rid of a lot of the things in the past that just weren't particularly good or weren't efficient and so on, and we'll start with something more efficient. I think a lot of companies are going to definitely be more efficient because of the better use of technology. That can be good. I do think technology, good technology, can also create a lot of jobs. It makes us more competitive. But what we're going to have to do is encourage the entrepreneur, because that's where the jobs will start. And of course, infrastructure will help. But then, of course, we must get rid of corruption. It is a massive issue, and it's going to be a massive issue going forward. You know, we can't have middlemen in this in the economy that don't add any value and that are beating the economy. We have to get rid of that. We have to be more efficient in the way we allocate our capital.
Absolutely. And if we strip out just that 15 to 20% that adds on, imagine what we could achieve with that. Then we might even be able to have a conversation around basic income grants. But until then, Paul, Laurie, thank you very much. Logging off for the last time with your First Rand hats on. It's been a great pleasure sharing your journey. And as I said earlier, I'm sure many MBA textbooks still to be written about the three founders from Stellenbosch. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, it all started in 1977, and the rest is indeed history. Thanks for watching.